OEA, OEA. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-3129. United States of America versus William Gray Bryant, a.k.a. Derek Thomas, the Appellant. Ms. Price, for the Appellant, and Ms. Dent, for the Appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court, Lisa Wright representing Mr. William Bryant. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Regarding the Speedy Trial Act claim that we've made, which goes only to count one, not to the count three that was indicted in the superseding at the last minute, there's a lot of calculations in the briefs, obviously, but it basically seems to come down to two issues. One is the effect of the government 609 pleading, and the second is the effect of the party's agreement to set the trial 4 months away in October, to set it for February. As to the 609 issue, it's our position that Harris controls, that 609 notices are not motions, that they are notices that allow the defendant under Rule 12B to make a motion to exclude.
The trial court seemed to think that there would be a hearing on that, what you call pleading or filing, and what the government calls a motion. Doesn't that suggest that it is a motion?
Well, he said I'm not going to decide that till later, but he didn't necessarily say there was going to be a hearing on it. Mm-hmm. He didn't talk about having a hearing. He said I don't decide those until closer to trial generally. That's mm-hmm. just as a practice, he said. Mm-hmm. But
decide those. I mean, that suggests that there's something in front of him that will take his time
right.
and attention and energy. That sounds like a motion.
Well, he was assuming, I think, at that point that the defendants were opposing it. But then when the defendants said, you know, we were trying to decide whether to file something and I wasn't going to, but now that you've ruled as you have on my motion to suppress today, I think I might want to file an opposition. And Judge Friedman said, that's fine, and you can have 3 weeks till October 28th to do that. Then when no opposition is filed, to the extent there ever was a motion, there is no motion filed by the defense at that point.
Well, assume there's a motion. Don't you still end up with a calculation that's a problem?
Yes.
I mean, I think you're on very shaky ground, quite frankly, on the motion argument. I'll have to ask the governor about this, too. It's a conjunction between 3161 H1F and H1J.
That's right.
And once the judge had the motion under advisement, if it is a motion,
right,
it stops after 30 days, and that's what the court in Henderson says.
Right.
And that takes you past the Speedy Trial Act.
Well, that's our alternative argument, yes, that when he gave him a deadline of October 28th, and on October 28th, in the words of the Supreme Court in Henderson, the judge had all the papers he could reasonably expect and was in a position to decide the motion. So then he can take as long as he wants to decide it, but Judge Friedman himself recognized that Provision J probably only excludes 30 days. He acknowledged that, but he thought it didn't matter because once that clock started ticking, he thought that this waiver kicked in and eliminated the problem, which it did not. But that's exactly right. And
your waiver argument is just simply there can't be a prospective waiver.
Correct.
Right?
I mean,
and there were no express findings.
It was the most brief.
In fact, at one point, I think the judge made it clear, gee, did I make express findings on one part of it anyway, didn't he?
He said, I don't know what I said,
yeah,
but.
And he hadn't.
Right. And he said, I don't remember. We'll have to look at the transcript. It would be my normal practice to say such and such. But he didn't. And really, it was just an incredibly brief setting of the trial date. And, you know, really a very typical procedure pre-Zedner. Because pre-Zedner, you know, setting trial dates, you know, district judges tended to defer to the defense counsel as to when they wanted to have the trial, if they weren't pushing for a trial, and if their client was not locked up. The judge did not take a whole lot of, you know, was not sort of taking the public interest side of it and really putting the defense counsel's feet to the fire or the prosecutor's feet to the fire to explain why this was necessary, because everyone thought the defendant could waive the Speedy Trial Act. So the public's interest wasn't really considered. And it's only after Zedner that we realized that what that procedure was flawed.
Well,
and that's
he did say something about on the 14th of March, didn't he? It's done in the interest of justice, because otherwise we force one or the other defendants to go to trial with someone who's not their lawyer, or a lawyer just coming off another trial, whatever the situation was?
Well, I believe, if in context, what he's saying there is he is, let me find the page.
It's page 10 of the March 14th.
He's talking sort of hypothetically there about what he would normally do, and he is assuming, because he says, you know, it would have been, if it wasn't explicit, it would have been implicit, because otherwise I wouldn't have put it off to February. He's saying, I must have thought it was necessary.
Yeah, I mean, those are his reflections. He's pondering, gee, did I do it?
Right.
And he said, he realized he didn't do it. And he said, well, gee, if I had thought about it, I would have. So I'm going to make it implicit. And the question is, I don't know how the law embraces that. I don't know how you can get away with that after the fact. It's after the fact. The findings have to be in anticipation, at least as I understand it.
Right.
They can't be a postscript when the time period is run.
Right. Zedner leaves open somewhat when the judge has to put the findings on the record.
Zedner just drops a footnote saying it would be the better practice to make them contemporaneously with the continuance, but that doesn't mean it's necessary. There's nothing in the Speedy Trial Act that requires a finding to be made exactly when the continuance is granted.
Well, I agree. Zedner doesn't decide when it has to be said, but Zedner does say very clearly that in the judge's mind, the balancing must be done in the judge's mind at the time the continuance is granted. I think that's quoted in our reply brief. That's straight from Zedner, that at least in the judge's mind it has to be done, and then he can say it later, maybe.
Well, Judge Friedman's saying that it wasn't his mind.
But he didn't have...
He's saying that have to grant the continuance, otherwise they go to trial with either a lawyer not of their choice or a lawyer who's not familiar with the case.
I think he's thinking he must have thought that because he granted it, but he didn't have the information to even make that kind of balancing, because he actually didn't inquire of the parties of their availability. He got their preferences, as I said, standard practice.
Well, Quint, he actually did hear from the stand-in for Quint, didn't he?
Well, what happened was he said, I can do November 14th or I can do December. And the other lawyer for Mr. Walker said, I would prefer December. Well, let me just read the exact. I don't want to...
No one said anything about November, did they?
Nobody said a thing about November. That's exactly right. And so then when the other lawyer says, I would prefer December, judge says, what's happening in December? He directs that question to Ms. Quint's stand-in. And she says, well, I would actually ask for January because of Ms. Quint's December schedule. And so November is never discussed. And then from there, they quickly jump and they decide January's kind of booked up and generally congested, which the government acknowledges general congestion isn't really a reason not to have the trial or not to exclude time. And then they jump to February 22nd and everybody's happy with that. But the only explicit days that are really discussed, and remember, this was only a 3-day trial.
Is the general congestion part of the public interest?
Pardon? I didn't.
But why isn't general congestion in the court part of the public interest?
Well, I think the idea is that if one judge is congested, you're supposed to find another judge to take it, which does happen for speedy trial purposes.
It wasn't just one factor to be taken into account.
Well, and just, I mean, the statute explicitly says that general congestion of the court's calendar is not a reason to grant a ends of justice continuance. They're trying to discourage that. I think they see that as too big of a loophole. But what I was going to say was that this is only a 3-day trial. Everyone has agreed that they expect it to take 3 days, and it's sort of almost inherently obvious that nobody was claiming to be entering into a months-long trial. They had 4 months that they could have found, I'm sure, if they had tried.
When did the
3 days
occur that are the subject of this trial?
The events, I believe it was January 05.
No, the crimes.
I think it was January 05.
So the statute of limitations hasn't run 5 years.
No, I wouldn't think so.
And even if Judge Friedman had granted the motion to dismiss, he could have granted it without prejudice to reindict.
That's correct. And he still could. If this court, and again, it applies only to count one in any event. Count three is going to stand. But if this court were to find that speedy trial was violated as to count one, then it could remand. I think that's been the general practice, to remand to the district court to decide with or without.
Are you familiar with the demand rule? Do you remember what the demand rule was? was, there's a Supreme Court case back in the early 1970s, 71, 72, somewhere around there, called Barker versus Wingo, which really brought about the Speedy Trial Act. It's an opinion by Justice Powell dealing with the demand rule. The rule used to be that, in recognition of the fact that delay helps the defendant more often than it helps the government. And defense counsel really liked delays because witnesses tend to forget and they disappear and so on. And who knows what can happen. So the rule used to be that unless the defendant demanded a speedy trial, then you could not bring or could not claim the lack of a speedy trial. And the time began running only from the point of a demand. Okay, so now we have Zedner and, you know, the interplay between that. But the demand rule may not be relevant under the Act to the 70-day period, but it does seem to me that the demand rule is relevant to the question whether the dismissal should be with prejudice or without prejudice.
Well, that might be. That might be. But we're not making a claim under the Sixth Amendment, which
I understand.
Barker, yeah. I understand the point. But, Zedner has sort of breathed life into something. It basically made clear that even technical failures to comply with the Act, they've made it into a very technical thing. It can't be harmless, et cetera. So that's where we are. If there's no more questions on speedy trial.
And the superseding indictment doesn't restart the clock?
Not on any count that was already charged, or one that, by virtue of double jeopardy, had to have been charged. So
we've got a holding on that. We have a holding.
Yes. I think I cited a case on that. And it seems certainly clear as to count one, which had already been charged. And then count three, I think as I footnote, the parties below seem to think count three should have been charged with count one. I frankly couldn't find authority for that, so I'm not arguing that. I wanted to move on and touch at least a little bit on the jury question and note, which went to really the most central and critical issue of the case. The only real dispute in the case was the defendant's mental states regarding the control of the guns. And, the hardest job a jury has is to find someone's mental state beyond a reasonable doubt. And they have to really make a leap into someone's mind and do a little bit of make a little bit of a jump, and that's a hard thing to do. And they quickly seized on that as the hard question. They wrote a note saying, please tell us what control means with respect to intent and constructive possession. And as it was objected to below, we feel that the Alexander instruction, which was taken out of context from a sufficiency case by this court, where the court said that proximity plus, quote, evidence of some other factor, and then gives a list of examples, may suffice to establish constructive possession, which essentially took control out of the equation. I think the first problem with it is that by taking this legal sufficiency language out of context, the court is dealing with this hypothetical super conviction-prone juror, the most conviction-prone person you could have who would still be called rational.
The shotguns were charged in separate counts.
No. One was charged as a unregistered firearm because only one was sawed off sufficiently to qualify. But under the 922G felon in possession count, three, both guns were charged.
Okay, on the felony.
Yeah.
Now, so if he possessed one as opposed to two, still be guilty, right?
Correct.
All right. Doesn't it seem, if the jury used its common sense, these are shotguns, these aren't pistols, right? And it seemed very, very unlikely that one person could use two shotguns simultaneously.
Well, but one was left behind in the car.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
Yeah, but we just don't know
so
who was in control. Well, we don't know who was in. I mean, the point is they have to figure out who's in control of it. Is the driver, does he own two shotguns?
But there's no question that Mr. Bryant was in the passenger seat, right?
Right.
And it was the shotgun was found underneath the passenger seat in plain view.
It was partially covered. We acknowledge that there was sufficient evidence that it could be seen.
Yeah. So do you dispute that he knew that it was there?
No. I mean, well, we don't dispute there was sufficient evidence that a jury could find it was there.
Right,
no.
Right, okay.
But that he knew. So we're really focusing not on the knowledge of the gun, but the intent to control it. And to figure that out, you really need to get into the minds of, you know, who was in charge, who did these belong to, was one person letting the other person, you know, use their weapon or help participate in the...
But you don't dispute that they were both engaged in a criminal enterprise?
Well, we acknowledge that there was sufficient evidence that they were doing something together.
Something together.
Yeah.
Something criminal.
They were planning
a crime together.
Well, it was...
Government
didn't have to prove and they didn't attempt to prove what was going on. But it's our position that as to whether that involved the gun and whether my client had control of the gun and had an ability to participate in jointly determining what's going to be done with either of those guns was a question that, if there was sufficient evidence, was nevertheless an extremely difficult question and one the jury immediately seized on, and it was just extremely important that the answer be crystal clear and 100% accurate. And unfortunately, I think that because of the way this court's statement was, which didn't mention control, because in context it's clear to the lawyers reading the opinion what the court means, but when you read something like that to a lay jury that takes the word control out, they've asked for a definition of control. But by giving them examples that, in response to that request for definition of control, it suggests that the examples define control as opposed to just permitting an inference of it.
There are other problems with it, not the least of which is that there's no factual basis for a good deal of what the court said in quoting Alexander. There's no factual basis in this case for a gesture or... What else was it? A statement indicating involvement?
Right, you're exactly right. There's no statement.
So a gesture implying control, evasive conduct. There's none of that here. So there's no factual basis. But the problem is there was no objection to this, right?
Well, they fought about it a lot. They fought to keep this instruction out originally. And then the judge agreed, fine, I will just give the red book. And he gives the red book, and they give their closing arguments. If, for example, the defendant had known or defense counsel had known this was going to be given, they could have addressed some of these examples in the closing, but they didn't. So after they've already argued over whether this thing's appropriate or not, then when the jury question comes in, they have a whole new argument where there's a lot of back and forth about the defendant saying, we don't want these examples, and the judge said at the end, well, if there's a conviction, then that's another issue for appeal. It seems clear Judge Friedman knew he was taking a chance. He made a calculated risk that he thought this instruction was helpful. And, you know, he gave them three different sort of definitions. And, you know, we don't have a problem with the first two. The Pardo one is okay because it leaves in what Alexander takes out, which is it says, it gives little examples of things you must find. But then it says show a stake or power in the weapon. And that's the part that is taken out of Alexander. It just says just the example. So it substitutes, you know, it replaces this difficult question of control with these easier sort of sub-questions of these examples, which I think could be misinterpreted. The jury could say, well, he was acting kind of evasive, therefore he must have had the gun. He must be in constructive possession of the gun, when really they need to go that next step and be persuaded beyond a reasonable doubt in their mind that evasiveness or that gesture actually is evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to them of control.
The sawed-off shotgun was with Walker.
They were both sawed off. The one that was sufficiently short to qualify was left in the car.
Okay.
That's my memory. If there's no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
We have no time, but we'll give you.
Oh, I thought, okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, John Gadez on behalf of the United States. This Court should not dismiss count one of the indictment because there was no violation of the Speedy Trial Act in this case. First of all, with respect to the 609 motion, I'm going to call it a motion. That's what it was called when it was filed, a notice and a motion. And it is clear from the proceedings in this case and in the full context that it was treated by everyone. It was treated by the parties and it was treated by the court.
I don't need wasting time on that. They're not spending time on whether it's a motion or not. The problem is the count. Assume it's a motion.
Okay. Assume it's a motion. On October 7th, appellant indicated that, or co-appellant, or co-defendant Walker, indicated that they opposed the motion that the government had filed. It's joined. And that he wants to file something. Now, there's no indication in the record in this case that the court ever considered this as a dormant issue after October 28th or at any time thereafter. on October 28th, to be sure, before any, the primary issue that it was addressed on that case was when we were going to set this case down for trial. But later on, in February, when the superseding indictment was filed, it's clear at that time that Mr.
Wait,
Walker...
Wait, are you suggesting it wasn't under advisement?
It was not under advisement at that time.
Why wouldn't it be under advisement if the judge sets a date of October 28th? It's under advisement at that point. I mean, it's just so easy to avoid the requirements of the Act to say, well, you know, you can set the date, and that's, and then the statute says it's 30 days. You've got two statutory provisions, and the court went on at length in Henderson to make it clear we're not going to allow circumvention by going back to H1F. And so H1J is in play. It's not to exceed 30 days. It's under advisement, then. The
except
court said
that,
that's when the motion is to be considered. Now, the court doesn't do it. That's too bad.
Well, except that in this case, afterwards, in February, when the superseding indictment is returned, there is a hearing on the day, or there is a discussion, a colloquy on the day of the superseding indictment return. And it's clear that on that case that the court still regarded it as something that is at play. Indeed, the counsel for Walker acknowledged.
You mean still pending?
Still pending.
Yeah, right.
And counsel for Walker.
That's my point. It was still under advisement. Still, but the 30 days had run under H1J.
It hadn't run in, at least in counsel for Walker's mind.
Oh, that doesn't matter. I mean, that we surely wouldn't decide it on that basis. Counsel said, oh, gee, I didn't think it ran. That's not the way we would decide the case.
Counsel for Walker still indicated at that point and even after that time that he wanted to file something in response to what the government had submitted. And he did file something. Walker filed something that was joined by.
But that's way after the 30-day period that controls the trial court had passed.
It's our position.
I don't know how that retroactively does anything to the statutory rule that says within 30 days. And now we're running. You can't retroactively say, oh, wait, well, let's not count those now.
Well, I would submit
that. There's a much more interesting question as to whether or not the judge, and the one that Judge Randolph was asking about, whether or not Judge Friedman really had made the determination in the interest of justice. But I don't know how I don't see how you avoid the count problem. This motion was, I'm going to give you, it was a motion, I'll give you, but it was under advisement.
The court specifically, the district court specifically didn't take it under advisement on October 28th. And thereafter regarded it as
you're saying your view is the district court has to reassert itself. Having set the date, it's not under advisement unless the district court says. I mean, that's just a circumvention. That's exactly what Henderson seemed to me to be saying, that we're not going to allow that kind of game playing. I don't know why the government would push that point. I mean, that's exactly what the court said. Right or wrong, that's what they said.
Well, and you also have the context in this case, the additional facts that a hearing was held in this case. A hearing was held in which Appellant Walker vigorously contested what the government was doing with respect to the 609 information, and the judge regarded it as something that had to be decided. And so I don't think that the district court certainly explicitly treated this as a dormant issue. With respect to...
These defendants testified.
Neither one testified.
Neither one.
Neither one testified. At the time of the hearing, Mr. Walker's counsel indicated that Mr. Walker might still testify. It was going to depend in part on what happened at the hearing on the 609 motion. There was a hearing on the 609 motion. Mr. Walker ultimately decided not to testify. With respect to the interest of justice issue in terms of what happened
in most criminal cases, defendant doesn't testify. Often the defense counsel will say that they haven't made their mind up and that he may testify. And you know, it's a game that's played day after day. You know that, and anybody who's tried criminal cases knows that. So judges, it would seem to me that a judge is really not using his time or her time wisely by deciding well before trial whether the 609 impeachment is going to be proper. Because nine times out of ten, the issue's moot.
It may be or it may be not. If the government can't impeach a defendant with his prior felony convictions, then there's perhaps a greater likelihood that particular defendant may want to take the stand and take his chances.
Well, it might be a greater likelihood, but it's still very unlikely. I mean, can you imagine the cross-examination of these two gentlemen? Regardless whether you could take a prior and impeach them with it. I mean, my goodness, you know, what were you doing at 3 in the morning in Chinatown with a sawed-off shotgun under your coat?
I don't imagine the cross-examination. I dream about it.
You're right.
But in terms of, and incidentally, I believe you asked whether there was a case in this circuit. I think the Marshall case is a case in this circuit. This speedy trial doesn't start to begin on a superseding indictment until the return of that indictment.
Is that the uniform rule throughout the circuit?
It is for at least the 5th and I think an 11th circuit, which are two other cases that I looked at.
Can't get that from the statute.
It doesn't appear obvious from the statute.
Judge Friedman seemed to have doubt about it.
Well, the reason that Judge Friedman may have expressed some doubt about it was because the way this was teed up was not that the count one should be dismissed for violation of the treaty. Speedy Trial Act, the way it was teed up initially at the arraignment hearing and thereafter in the pleadings was that it should be dismissed because it's just not that count two or count three and four should be dismissed because it's not fair that the government waited so long to return a superseding indictment. So when this first came up, there was no issue at all with respect to whether or not count one should be dismissed as a violation of the Speedy Trial Act. So to the extent that Judge Friedman may have spoken about the count three and four, that was the reason why. With respect to the interests of justice and what occurred on October 28th, to be sure, Judge Friedman didn't fully articulate on October 28th his findings, but he did at the hearing in March. And under Zedner, there's no prohibition on the court making those findings reaching back to October 28th. And indeed, there's a case, I believe, in this circuit. I don't believe it's cited in our brief, but I think it's an Edwards case. It's called Edwards. I'm sorry, Judge. It's called Edwards, United States versus Edwards.
That's one of my bad days.
That specifically talks about that. And I think I may, if I have it at
Wasn't that from 1980? Wasn't that well before Zedner?
It was well before Zedner, 627 F. Second 460. It's a 1980 case. But the court said that the findings need not be placed on the record at the time the continuance is granted. But in this case,
a lot going pre-Zedner, though. I mean, I think there's a perfectly reasonable argument to be made there, but that's not overly helpful, is it?
Well, I think in March, Judge Friedman does make those findings that, look, if we had tried to go to trial in December or January, one or the other or both of these defendants would have had to seek other counsel.
What about the fact that no one said anything about his suggestion of November 14?
There was silence about the November date, and I think, and this is perhaps speculation, that it arose in this fashion. As soon as the Judge Friedman mentioned that he could give the defendants a speedy trial in November or December, the prosecutor immediately indicated that she was available on, I believe it was December the 5th. And at that point, the discussion was joined about the unavailability of the other counsel for any dates in December or January. And so the court or the parties never got back to a November date. And it may be that the prosecutor herself was not available in November, which is why she suggested the December 5th date. So it's true there was specifically no discussion about setting a trial date in November. But the reason that the trial was set in February was purely driven by the fact that if there had been an earlier trial date, apparently one or both defense counsel would not have been available.
Isn't the most elegant explanation for what took place what your opponent offered, and that is Judge Friedman was thinking about this was pre-Zedner, and wasn't thinking about ends of justice finding as much as he was that everyone agreed that February was okay. And he just didn't do anything necessarily wrong, just got caught in a change of law here. Right?
Well, I don't know that he did get caught in a change of law insofar as he specifically spoke about the interest of justice, He didn't use the ends of justice, but I don't think there's really much of a difference between ends of justice and interest.
But he didn't cover the entire period. I mean, that's the problem when you talk about November.
He was talking about from October the 28th onward in terms of the interest of justice that would bring us to the February dates at which—
There was no explanation as to why a case couldn't have gone on in November.
No, there was no explanation specifically because of the
way—
That's
what I mean. He did not address it. So, I mean, it was offered, it was available, and there was no explanation from the judge. Even assuming he can do it, and, you know, maybe he can, even assuming he can do it after the fact, he certainly didn't purport to try with respect to November.
I would agree that there was specifically no mention at that point of what about November, after the prosecutor had mentioned the availability in December. But clearly, even going back to the summertime, it was on Judge Friedman's mind. He was concerned about, first of all, he was certainly concerned about getting this case to trial, which is why he tried to set an earlier date. And although he didn't use the ends of justice language, even as early as July, he had talked about the interest of justice. He was concerned about if there was going to be a continuance, if there was going to be a tolling of the Speedy Trial Act, it wasn't going to be just a blanket for all time type of tolling. It was going to be a reason, and he articulated a reason, albeit later, with respect to the continuity of counsel issue, but he articulated a reason each time as to why tolling the period would be in the interest of justice. If there are no further questions with respect to the Speedy Trial Act issue and addressing the jury instruction issue, I think it's fairly clear both in this circuit and in other circuits that within a wide margin, a district court maintains discretion, an abundance of discretion in the precise manner and explains legal concepts to a jury. And in this case, Judge Friedman was entirely within his discretion in choosing to respond to the jury's note in the fashion that he did. First of all, it had been suggested by the defendants in this case earlier on that language be included that came from, I believe, the Curry case in the initial instruction, and that was rejected in favor of just the Red Book instruction because Judge Friedman, even at the time of the initial instruction discussion, felt that if he were going to start pulling language from a case, the Curry case, for example, or Pardo case, which is what the defense wanted, that he was going to give a balanced instruction looking at the law from other cases. These were all sufficiency of the evidence cases, Alexander, Pardo, and Curry. Indeed, that's how the Red Book is basically written from case law in many cases dealing with sufficiency of the evidence. And when it came time to respond to the jury's note, after discussing this matter and hearing what the different parties suggested, Judge Friedman acted perfectly within his abundant discretion.
Let me ask you this I'm less interested in the instruction. I understand your argument on the sufficiency, and I understand standard of review on it. But I mean, how do you get over the problem on sufficiency here in light of some of the cases you're talking about when there's nothing to indicate, or what is it that you think indicates to the jury that this man had control over the shotgun?
Or helped guide the destiny. If this case, if one can see a situation here.
Do you know who owned the car?
I don't recall if there was, there's certainly no evidence in the record, I think, as to who owned the car. I don't recall that. We do know that clearly, and there's no issue about this, that appellant in this case was the front seat passenger,
right.
And that's
no,
where one of the shotguns is found on the floorboard.
You're certainly not arguing he had control over the gun that Walker had, right?
Well, in the sense that, for example, if their effort had been completed somehow, and it appears that they were staking out a bus and intended to rob the bus or its passengers, and Walker had wielded the gun at the time and the passengers were robbed, appellant in this case, Mr. Bryant, would have been culpable for possession of a firearm during the commission of a crime of violence.
It doesn't follow from that where the enterprise hasn't been conducted, that the same result follows.
Well, I think it may
ran,
because
one guy ran, one guy stopped. The guy with the gun ran. The the guy stopped. So, I mean, I don't know how you can, at least under the existing case law, I think you have a much harder case argument to make where there hasn't been any crime yet committed, other than the possession, the alleged possession of the guns. All right, so we're really focusing on the gun in the car. So
right, I wouldn't disagree that it's a harder case with respect to the gun that Walker dropped. With the gun in the car, you have this man repeatedly, or a couple times, getting in and out of the car. The gun's in plain view. This is where he sat. They were engaged in what appeared to be some sort of enterprise, certainly viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government. A reasonable jury could find that this appellant had control over the gun that was at his feet. I believe that the ammunition that was I can't remember. I have to go look at my facts, and I can tell that.
If we find there was sufficient evidence for his possession of the shotgun in the car, but insufficient evidence for his possession of the shotgun that Walker was carrying and the ammunition, what's the consequence?
The consequence is that appellant's convictions are confirmed. There was a special verdict form in this case in which a jury was required to answer with respect to each gun and the ammunition. And incidentally, the ammunition was in the 12-gauge shotgun that was dropped down the well by Mr. Walker. So the jury made a specific finding of guilt with respect to the shotgun in the car. So even if this court were to find that the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law with respect to the shotgun that Walker was carrying and dropped, the jury made a finding of guilt specifically with respect to the shotgun that was in the SUV. Thank you.
Give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. On the 609, I just wanted to make clear that once the motion was not opposed, and he was given the opportunity to oppose it, once it was not opposed, it is under advisement, and there's no reason to expect a hearing at that point. So the hearing issue, unlike I guess Holmes and Harris, where a hearing is either explicitly contemplated by the parties or actually held, that's not what happened here. The government mentions a hearing was ultimately held, but that was after the speedy trial motion had been denied, we say wrongfully. The clock had either ticked at that point or it had not. If it did, the fact that the Walker's lawyer then decided, and the judge permitted him to, the judge didn't have to permit him to file that motion, but he allowed him to file it late. He then had a hearing on it and ruled on it, but that's all after the speedy trial clock has already run. On the ends of justice,
is there any room under Zedner for an interpretation that says that what Zedner dealt with was a blanket anticipatory waiver of the Speedy Trial Act, whereas here what we don't have a blanket waiver, we have a specific waiver up to a certain point, namely the trial date. So,
I think not, because what Zedner is saying is that it's not up to the defendant to give up the public's interest in the speedy trial, and if the public's interest is going to be outweighed, it's got to be done under H8, ends of justice continuance. And on that subject, the one thing I wanted to say that I failed to say was critical, I think, is that when they're having this whole argument on March 14th, and at one point Walker's lawyer says, you know, it wasn't told by the what we said on the 28th, I was only extending it, he had this argument, and the judge said, no, it's not told, it's waived. That I think that's pretty critical, is what how the judge viewed it. He really viewed it as a waiver, and the evidence of that further is that nowhere does he ever mention the public interest.
What page of the March are you relying? Is it page 14?
I apologize. Let's see. I know I do have it cited in my reply brief.
Because I'm not going to open it up, but he also said that down the bottom of that page, he said something in addition that the interests of justice allowed the waiver. Doesn't he?
I believe that, the paragraph you're talking about on page 10. On page 6 is where he says, February 22nd, because the defense lawyer is saying the time between October 28th and February 22nd was not told, and the court responds, February 22nd, no, it's waived. It's not told, it's waived. You explicitly waived your speedy trial rights when we set the trial date. Then he goes on to the paragraph Your Honor is talking about, and I, you know, my grammar is not, my grammar is not that great, but he's...
Yeah, it almost is, the way he's treating it, the way I read it was that, you know, I'm going to allow the waiver because it was in the interest of justice to allow it.
And he says, I must have done that, is what he really says. I must have done that because I wouldn't have allowed it if I didn't think it was in the interest of justice. But again...
No. In the paragraph that I'm talking about, is the one on the bottom.
He says, what I would typically have done...
No. Clear this up.
I think it's linked back again to, but it's done in the interest of justice on page 10, because otherwise we would force one or the other of the defendants to go to trial. He's speaking like that's how I do it, not how it was done in this case. He's not saying it was done. He's saying when I do these things, it's done in the interest of justice, because otherwise we're forcing people to trial, or a lawyer is just coming off another trial, or whatever the situation was. He's saying, I don't remember what happened here, but that's how I do these things. And what we're saying is, even if that is how he normally does it.
It's a paragraph at the bottom of 10 that I'm thinking of. Is there a difference under the Speedy Trial Act, putting aside your other arguments for the moment, between tolling by operation of law when motions are filed and the waiver in the interest of justice? Or don't you just add those two numbers together to figure out whether the 70 days should be applied? I won't use the word has run because obviously it's run. But should it be applied if there's been an explicit waiver on the record for the kinds of reasons that happened in this case? So in other words, it certainly sounds like what he's saying is that I'm allowing the waiver in the interests of justice, or I allowed the waiver in the interests of justice for the reasons.
That typically would have been what I would have done. But I go back to the point that he couldn't have done that here because he didn't have the information he needed to do it. There's nothing in the record suggests there weren't 3 days that these three or four parties could have found to try this case over a four-month period.
If we reversed count one but affirmed count two, would there have to be resentencing?
I think so.
Why would that be? They were concurrent, weren't they?
Yeah, but I think that any time you are convicted of fewer counts and different crimes, I really think the judge should have the opportunity to reconsider the sentence. Even if the guidelines are the same, I think that where the judge chooses to put you or go in or out of the guidelines.
Wait, you're telling us what you think would be good policy. Is there any law you're relying on?
Well, I know I can think of at least one case where that was the court's practice where...
No, I mean, is there anything in the guidelines or case law? Not someone's practice or what you think, sounds good, but I'm just curious as to whether there's any authority or something.
Well, 3553A.
I'm not doubting it. I'm just asking.
Yeah,
are you
I'm
resting
just saying,
on authority?
Big picture, I mean, 3553A says you have to consider everything. And one of the things you got to consider is what the entire range of convictions the defendant's liable for. And when they drop down from two counts to one count, I just think that's something the court might consider. He might not, but he might.
Why? This is relevant conduct, and even if the Speedy Trial Act ran on count one, the court could nevertheless consider the fact that the individual committed the offense. So.
He could, but I just think, I mean, pre-Booker, the answer might be different, but I do think under 3553A, you can't ignore the fact that a defendant stands convicted of fewer crimes and perhaps a less serious crime, even if his guidelines are the same. Guidelines don't really control. Did want to...
I think we have your argument.